Global shifts, local impacts. We connect the dots so you don't have to. From the BizNews studios, welcome to BizNews Daybreak for Friday, the 6th of February, 2026. I'm Alec Hogg. Here is the context you need to win the day. What a week it's been, and the Wall Street market sell-off is gathering momentum with another sharp decline last night. Amazon's post-results share price dropped into double figures at one point, off 11% before clawing its way back to around 7% lower, which is where it's likely to open up tonight. Same kind of hit for Bitcoin, although there it doesn't look like there's any pullback at the moment. It got smashed again to below $65,000. It's down almost half now from its high of just 4 months ago. Well, here's the freshest news from the late night team in the US at Bloomberg.
We begin with the stock market, where it was another day of heavy selling in software shares, given worries over the impact of AI. A new version of Anthropic's most powerful AI model can carry out financial research. It's also designed to be better at a range of other work-related functions, and that would include making spreadsheets and presentations, as well as software development. Today, the S&P 500 Software and Services Subindex fell by more than 4.5%. After the bell, Amazon's first quarter outlook was below consensus, and the company said it intends to spend $200 billion this year on data centers, chips, and other equipment. Now, the market is suspecting that Amazon's massive bet on AI will take longer to pay off than anticipated. Here is Bloomberg analyst Poonam Goyal.
They need to invest, right? We know that Amazon has to continue to invest in cloud services. It needs to invest in AI. So there's a lot of catch-up that needs to be done here. I think the long-run narrative here is still good. The underlying results were solid across both AWS and retail.
That is Bloomberg analyst Poonam Goyal. Shares in Amazon were down 10% in late U.S. trading. At the same time, there was a sell-off today in Bitcoin. It tumbled below 64,000 as an unwinding of leverage bets deepened. Bitcoin lost more than 12% during New York trading, and Nobel laureate Paul Krugman says Bitcoin is facing a real crisis of faith.
A lot of people sold Bitcoin as being the next gold, and it turns out that in the face of doubts about stability, doubts about politics, the next gold turns out to be gold, not Bitcoin. I think it's a big wake-up for people that, you know, maybe this isn't actually going to be an enduring asset.
That is Nobel laureate Paul Krugman speaking on Bloomberg Businessweek Daily. Bitcoin has wiped out all of its gains since President Trump's election set off a speculative rush into cryptocurrencies. Now, Bitcoin's plunge has rocked the digital asset complex, and few companies are more exposed than the Bitcoin treasury company Strategy, Inc. Today, after the bell, the company confirmed a net loss of $12.4 billion for the fourth quarter. Shares in Strategy, Inc. were down by more than 2% in late U.S. trading, but these shares have lost 45% of their value so far this year. Rio Tinto Group is walking away from talks to acquire Glencore. Such a deal would have created the world's largest mining company. However, the two sides failed to agree on valuation. Here is Bloomberg's Carmeli Argana.
I think the main point to consider is that there was this disagreement that they just couldn't get over between Rio Tinto and Glencore regarding the premium that Rio would be paying to acquire Glencore's shares. Now, Rio is almost twice the size of Glencore in terms of market capitalization. But from our reporting, from Bloomberg News reporting, I understand that Glencore had been seeking a share exchange ratio of that would have given investors about 40% of the company. So it was really that disagreement about the premiums that caused that deal to fall through.
That is Bloomberg's Carmeli Argana. Now, this deal would have also allowed Rio to double existing copper output.
Plenty more coming up in this episode on Bitcoin and investment markets generally. From the local perspective, though, the Rand is weaker again, now at 16 Rand 28 on a 1% drop in the gold price. Remember the correlation between those two. Gold goes down, Rand goes down. Gold goes up, Rand goes up, despite what the politicians are trying to let us believe when the Rand is strengthening. But there were signs of what was to come on the JSE again today when the resources sector yesterday afternoon dropped sharply It was down 5% overall resources, and that pulled the market 2% lower. All of Northam, Impala, and Platinum fell by 9%. What a whipsaw we're seeing at the moment. The market took the Sasol trading update relatively well. You might have recalled that they came out with numbers that are going to show their profits down between 89 and 99%. And the stock was, well, down 4%, which in the circumstances, not too bad. All of that was ahead, though, of last night's US market sell-off. And when New York gets a cold, Johannesburg tends to catch pneumonia. So fasten your seatbelt today. Let's start, though, with the two sides of the Bitcoin. First, Nobel Economics Laureate Paul Krugman. He's a research professor at the New York Graduate Center and a popular writer whose Substack has over 500,000 subscribers. He's also a famous Bitcoin cynic, and last night he spoke to our partners at the Bloomberg Businessweek podcast.
We have talked about crypto winters a few times in the past, and I got carried away with the winter metaphor. And in Norse mythology, the Fimbul winter is the final disastrous winter before Ragnarok, the end of all things. Crypto, it's a really weird space, right? If you ask, how is Bitcoin value compared to fundamentals? Well, what fundamentals? It's kind of all vibes. And it has bounced back several times from big declines because people had faith in it. And because it was, you know, there was a lot of ideology behind it. But this time looks different. This time, a lot of the recent rise has been driven by Strategy Inc. and other, crypto hoarders. A lot of it has been political, associated with Donald Trump. Everyone is comparing the price now to what happened when he won the election. And those things are harder. You know, the kind of sentimental or almost mystical attachment that people have had to Bitcoin itself probably doesn't apply to shares in Strategy. Probably doesn't. And the kind of libertarian ideology that supported Bitcoin doesn't really apply now that it's largely a political creation, and it's in some ways tied to what you think Trump's future prospects are. So this is different.
You know, I think about this a lot, Professor Krugman, and I think about supply demand, certainly when it comes to trades in assets. I'm not quite sure what you call cryptocurrencies. I think we still struggle with what it really is. Having said that, if President Trump wasn't in the White House, what's your view on whether or not crypto would be, you know, here around $64,000? Would it be a very different trade potentially?
Well, it might be. I don't think it would have gotten up to 125,000 or thereabouts without his election. It's possible that the day of reckoning might have waited longer. I mean, there was in some ways, the very prominence of crypto, the huge attention given to it, all of the hype about this is a crypto-friendly White House has in some ways, led to a big run-up, but also focused people's minds. And I think there's a lot more. So what is this actually for anyway? Mm-hmm. And there's also, there's the sell America trade, the debasement trade, which among other things, first of all, should have benefited Bitcoin if it was the kind of refuge asset that people had sold it as. But also the fact that a lot of people sold Bitcoin as being the next gold. And it turns out that in the face of doubts about stability, doubts about politics, the next gold turns out to be gold.
But there are two sides to every story. Carol and Tim spoke with Jurian Timor. He's director of the massive Global Macro Fidelity Investments, which has $17.5 trillion in assets under management. $17.5 trillion, that is. And of that, nearly $7 trillion they can decide to do with as they want. Discretionary assets, totally. Let's have a listen.
There's a few things going on. And by the way, I do disagree with Professor Krugman about the inability to value Bitcoin, because you can make that same argument for gold. And even though neither of those assets generate a cash flow, you can value them, right? You can value Bitcoin on the size of its network. It is a network asset. And you can value gold on the basis of, it being hard money. So you can compare it to soft money. So if you do a ratio of the gold above ground value to the M2 money supply, it goes in a band, in a ratio, if you will, and you can apply the same logic to Bitcoin. So I do think you can value them, and I do that. I compare the value of both gold and Bitcoin to the money supply, and they've both run a lot. You know, a few years ago, they were half the size of the money supply, but even gold on its own is now $35 trillion. The money supply is $23 trillion. Bitcoin is about $1.7 trillion in market value. So they've come a long way, and it's not that surprising that they're taking a rest. You know, Bitcoin did form kind of its fifth wave, if you will, 226,000. At 65,000, I actually think it has some value again, but they're different players on the same team. They take turns, and that's exactly what we've seen. So I don't think Bitcoin, its decline itself, will be a systemic event. You know, the last time it happened, it wasn't. It is getting caught up in the speculative, you know, first frenzy and then unfrenzy in you know, kind of the meme stocks and the non-profitable growth stocks, the other speculative names. And of course, we have the treasury, you know, those treasury companies that are really hurting right now. So it is part of a bigger picture, but I don't think it's going to lead to a systemic, you know, sell-off in assets in general.
On a US day when it was all about markets, the team at Bloomberg Business Week pulled in James Chalkmark, partner and chief investment officer at Clockwise Capital, to give some context. His fund also has a big holding in Amazon. Is he going to be buying more? Not just yet.
We're living in a world now, in a market now, where, you know, earnings, free cash flow, return on spend, all those things are important again. You know, just a couple of quarters ago, you couldn't spend enough and be rewarded for it. And now, you know, the market's kind of getting religion again as it relates to, you know, the financial performance and the financial expectations and projections for these companies. And, you know, it was bound to become relevant again at some point, and you know, really started last quarter with Broadcom in the month of December, and now you're seeing it percolate across all the companies reporting in January, February.
I want to ask you about what the details are that matter, and I'm looking at some other highlights from the press release from the last earnings. They announced, this is some of the highlights since the company's last earnings announcement, include that Amazon announced new AWS agreements with OpenAI, Visa, the NBA, BlackRock, Perplexity, Lyft, United Airlines, DoorDash, Salesforce, U.S. Air Force, Adobe, Thomson Reuters, AT&T, S&P Global, National Bank of Canada, London Stock Exchange Group, Choice Hotels, Accenture, Indeed, HSBC, CrowdStrike, and more. The reason I went through the list is because I feel like, you know, we have this question, is it just about the hyperscalers spending and building out? But what we're increasingly seeing, right, is more businesses tap into this. Can we make the assumption at this point, James, that these are businesses that are going to continue to have to spend with an Amazon, or for that matter, with an Alphabet?
Absolutely. I think you have to make that assumption. I mean, the world is only going in one direction. Productivity is only going to get grow. And you need to leverage the infrastructure that these companies have built in order to achieve those goals and capitalize on those opportunities. That being said, the money and the profits do matter. And we're going through a transition period right now where kind of growth assumptions are being revisited. Valuation assumptions are being revisited. I mean, if you look at all the companies that have reported thus far, and a lot of them have traded down, I think Meta being kind of the main exception, estimates have gone up for the most part. However, I mean, Palantir is actually the poster child for this. Estimates came up materially. However, the stock has since fallen back a lot. And what that means is when estimates go up and the stock goes down, that means there's valuation compression. You're seeing the market right now north of 3x sales. Valuations are at or near all-time highs, and you know they have to come in.
Back onto the news that's getting us excited here in South Africa, from paper bags of cash to jet skis and even Ozempic deliveries for top brass. Is this the state of South Africa's security cluster? Well, Chris Stein sat down with political analyst Professor Theo Fenter to expose the dangerous entanglement of our police and military with political power. They discussed the unconventional General Mkhwanazi, the rot spreading in the Navy, and why we urgently need generals out of politics and politicians out of administration. You can catch that full interview on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio, but let's give you a little highlight.
If General Mkhwanazi did not call that shock press conference, do you think General Sibiya would eventually have become National Police Commissioner and Mr. Matunu might even have become the next president of the African National Congress?
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario that you're talking about, because there is criticism on Mkhwanazi himself, and we've seen some pushback through the evidence led by McBride and one or two others. And of course, Paul O'Sullivan is still running around. They haven't cornered him yet. And I'm sure he's going to give some pushback. And I think the recommendations would include a reference to how Mkhwanazi did it, because it was unconventional. And if you take the Mkhwanazi example, and you see how it spilled over into the Defense Force, where the Chief of the Navy are now talking closely and he's saying things about his political overseers, which I think is militarily uncalled for. The Chief of the Health Services did the same. And the Iran participation, the naval exercises, it tells you that there's a big problem at the top structure of the Defense Force, and I think they took a leave from what happened in the police. And I think one of the recommendations would be, if I can describe it in the following way, that politicians must get out of administration, and the administration, meaning the generals or the commissioners, must get out of politics. And what we've seen in these investigations is that those two are too closely intertwined, and the untangling of that is really astonishing if you see how deep it goes, where paper bags were delivered, the newest evidence, how Ozempic, the wonder drug nowadays, how that was delivered to certain police officers, jet skis, boats, weddings. It's just incredible how this social events, social parties. For me, as a political analyst, it was interesting every time when I saw on TV or personally when I attended as an analyst that police officers are at the ANC's annual elective conference. They shouldn't be there unless they're protecting the politicians, but they can't be there participating, and they were there. And the same with the military. And I think if these two investigative bodies can do anything, it's to take those things a little bit further out of reach, and so that we get a better governed police, a better governed defense force. I know this interview is not about the defense force, but it's about the security structures in general, and that politicians know where their limitations are.
How do you separate the bystanders from the enablers? Well, that's the task facing journalists right now as they pass millions of newly released documents from the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. It's a chaotic data dump involving broken IT systems and redaction errors. We're going to play you a clip from the Financial Times' news briefing featuring Chris Cook, who's head of the FT's computational journalism team. He explains how they are distinguishing between casual photo ops and the deep transactional relationships that really mattered in the Epstein universe. It's a fascinating story and it'll give you better context for how to understand all of the sagas that are coming out of the Epstein files, including, from your own perspective, to at least have some sympathy for those names who've just been dumped in there because Epstein was wanting to cultivate them, and to contrast them with, well, those who he certainly did facilitate.
The U.S. Department of Justice has released millions of documents in recent days related to the late convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. They show his broad ties to the world's most powerful people. But the release has been rocky, and so is the task of trying to parse these files. Chris Cook has been overseeing a team of FT journalists poring over the documents. He's our enterprise editor and head of the computational journalism team, and he joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hiya.
So tell us how this information has been released, because it seems like it's kind of a unique case and frankly, kind of hard to follow.
So this story is like a particular technical challenge for newsrooms. First of all, just because of the sheer size of the document drop, which is far larger than anything else we've really ever had to deal with at speed. And the second thing is that the Department of Justice's IT systems have really struggled to deliver stuff. You've probably read that they've had trouble redacting documents. Some victims' names have appeared in things. Some explicit photographs have been published too. And as they've been spotting those things, they've been pulling down thousands of documents from their website so they're no longer available, you know, fixing them up and then putting them back. And what that means is that basically at any given moment when you look at their website, you'll get a slightly different selection of documents that you can download. And it's meant that as we have been trying to gather these things so we can sift them, what is available has changed from hour to hour.
Okay, so this sounds like an incredibly complicated thing for you to parse. How are you going about it?
So the first thing we want to do is actually make it searchable by our reporters. So we've been putting it into tools that make it searchable. We've also got this challenge that because the DOJ has said that some of the things that we've downloaded should be redacted and are not appropriate, we've been having to set up processes to basically check those documents for that so that we can destroy things that we frankly do not want to end up holding. The central challenge is that humans on their own going through millions and millions of documents, it will take months to handle this, even for a newsroom of our size. But we have to do it, you know, for the dignity and respect of these victims and because we don't want our colleagues to come across anything that they shouldn't see.
Chris, because this has become a bit of a mess, how should people think about some of the names that have been released in the Epstein files? Because from my understanding, just because you are named in the Epstein files doesn't necessarily mean that you had direct contact or did any of the wrongdoing that is associated with Jeffrey Epstein.
So one of the things that sort of emerges when you look across such a wide range of his correspondence is you see it's not just the photos of him and the Pope and the Clintons and the very famous people and the bank CEOs. There's clearly a big spectrum of people who had these sort of long, deep relationships with him, like Jess Staley, a former CEO of Barclays. And there are people who have more ambiguous relationships with him. So Kathy Rimmler, who is the general counsel at Goldman Sachs, talks to him a lot. He does a lot of favors for her. You know, he sends beauticians around to her house and things like that. There's sort of nice little gifts he sends her all the time. Then there are people who have much more passing relationships with him. His sort of gift is working out what favors he can do for you to help you and keep you in his network.
Now, both Staley and Rimmler say they were unaware of Epstein's activities. Chris, the Department of Justice recently held a press conference about the document release. A reporter asked Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche about victims' frustration over the release process, and I want to play part of his response.
I hope that the work that the men and women within this department have done over the past 2 months hopefully is able to bring closure. I think that what we told our reviewers is that was the goal. You know, there's this mantra out there that, oh, you know, the Department of Justice is supposed to protect Donald J. Trump. And that's what we were telling. That's not true. That was never the case. We are always concerned about the victims.
Chris, what have you found?
We are quite time-bound, so this is particularly from around 2010. This is what this document really relates to. It's after the period where we think that their friendship was at its peak. So to some extent, it's understandable there's not a lot of Trump in there. There's a lot of him complaining about Trump and a lot of him spreading rumors about him and gossiping about him. And he's obviously like a character in the Epstein universe. But he's clearly a departed character from the Epstein universe in the documents. The extent to which it's like a deliberate thing and the extent to which they've partially released information so that it won't touch the devil cut Trump stuff is unclear. But they've produced, if you like, quite a natural feeling body of work that does manage to exclude the president and his family pretty successfully.
Chris, how much more data are we expecting to come out?
So this is still an incomplete release. We know there are hundreds of thousands of pages more out there. So the short answer is we don't know. and we don't know whether that stuff is ever going to be released. We've got quite a partial view of Epstein's life. So to give you an example of what I mean by that, we see a lot of emails he sends to himself, which appear to be him drafting up letters to send to people. And we never see the thing that's actually sent to the recipient. And we think that basically we're missing a sort of chunk, if you like, of office correspondence. And there's a lot of stuff that's not really about Jeffrey Epstein. So he invested in a lot of companies, and we've got a lot of internal correspondence from some of his investments, which we would otherwise not have. Just from what we've got now, there's a lot of information in there. There's probably going to be quite a long tail.
That's the FT's Chris Cook. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the weekend does beckon, but my goodness, we got another day to get through, and it's been quite a week, hasn't it? Well, now you have the edge because you have the information. For the full interviews and details behind these stories, head over to biznews.com. I'm Alec Hogg. Thanks for starting your morning with us. Thanks for being with us again today. I'm taking a short break Monday, Tuesday next week. You'll be in the capable hands of the BizNews team. And, well, I'll be back again on Wednesday. But for now, go and seize the day.